Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are jumping way back, all the way to 12th century Japan.
We are. We're tackling a really foundational work, The Tale of the Haik, or Haik Monogatari. It's huge for understanding samurai culture, Japanese Buddhism.
And just, well, power itself.
Exactly. This isn't just some old war story about the Genpei War, though that's the setting.
Which was around 1180 to 1185.
Yep. But the core of it, the real takeaway, is this idea of impermanence. The Japanese call it Muju.
Okay.
And the Haik story, this powerful Taira clan, their spectacular rise and equally spectacular fall. It's like the perfect case study.
How success leads to arrogance, which leads to, well, disaster.
Precisely. It's timeless. That's why we're looking at it. It gives you a framework for seeing how power cycles work, how pride can bring down anyone or anything.
So, yeah, that's the hook for you listening. It's this incredibly dramatic story. The rise and fall of the Haik, the Taira clan.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a lens, you know.
Mm-hmm.
For looking at powerful institutions today, political, corporate, whatever, and maybe spotting those same patterns, those signs of decline.
Our mission today, then, is to follow that path from absolute dominance to total annihilation.
And maybe figure out why this specific tragedy became such a cornerstone, like a moral lesson for Japan afterwards.
Right. But first, we should probably talk about the book itself, because it's, well, it's unusual.
How so?
Well, if you're looking for a single author, like, you know, written by John Smith, you won't find one. It's basically anonymous.
Huh. That is interesting, given how important it is. So no single historian sitting in a room writing it down.
Nope. It seems it was compiled, shaped over time, by these traveling blind Buddhist monks. They were called biwa hushi.
Biwa, like the instrument.
Exactly. They recited these tales, often really dramatically, accompanying themselves on the biwa, which is a kind of Japanese lute.
Okay, so that changes things. It's not just dry history.
Not at all. It means the epic is this amazing blend. You've got historical events, sure, but also legendary stories. Maybe some exaggeration.
And layered over all of it is this deep religious commentary, this Buddhist worldview.
Right. That whole pride comes before a fall thing. It's not just an interpretation someone added later. It's baked in from the start because these monks were telling the story.
So it's like collective memory and a sermon. Almost.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Its authority doesn't come from one person claiming objectivity, but from how it shaped Japan's whole ethical thinking, even the early ideas about what it meant to be a warrior.
Got it. Okay, so let's dive into the story itself. The central conflict. It's between two big warrior families, right?
The Taira, who are also called the Haik, and the Minamoto, also known as the Genji.
And at the start, the Haik aren't just winning. They're completely running the show.
Oh, totally dominant. Under this one guy, Taira no Kiyomori, he was formidable. He mastered politics, married into the imperial family.
Basically controlled the whole court. Didn't he even put his own grandson on the throne?
Yep, the young Emperor Antoku. He was only, what, 8 years old?
Wow, and that's where the arrogance starts to creep in or maybe flood in?
Absolutely. Power corrupts, as they say, and Kiyomori's power became absolute. This leads to that infamous line.
The one that sums up their hubris.
Yeah. If you are not a Haik, you are not a man. I mean, can you imagine?
That's staggering. Believing your family name defines humanity itself. You're basically saying, we're done for, right?
Yeah,
there.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why the story works so well as this spiritual allegory. It's a massive cautionary tale.
About karma.
Yeah, about karmic retribution, Inga. The Haik built their power on cruelty and pride, and the story shows how that guaranteed their destruction. It just took 5 years of brutal war for it all to play out.
Okay, let's trace that collapse. Phase one, you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
The peak, the zenith of power.
Right, books 1 to 3, roughly. This part shows just how powerful Kiyomori was and how ruthless he was in keeping that power.
He wasn't just sidelining rivals, was he?
No, he was actively dismantling the whole system of checks and balances. He disrespected the retired emperor, violently crushed plots like the Shishinotani incident. He was basically trying to make his family's power permanent.
Which, from a Buddhist perspective, is impossible. You can't stop change.
Precisely. It's like, imagine a modern CEO who doesn't just beat the competition, but starts firing the board, ignoring regulators, silencing all internal dissent.
Consolidating power until they're totally isolated. Dangerous.
Very. And that isolation leads right into phase two. The war kicks off. The Minamoto clan finally gets rallied by Prince Mokihito. He saw Kiyomori as a tyrant.
And this is where things start to go wrong for the hike. Like,
Yeah.
really visibly wrong.
Oh, yeah. There's this almost darkly funny moment, the Battle of Fujikawa.
What happened there?
Well, the hiking army, probably overconfident, but maybe getting a bit soft.
Yeah.
They hear this noise in the night. Turns out it was just a huge flock of water birds taking off.
Okay.
But they panic. They think it's a massive surprise attack by the Minamoto. Yes. They just flee in total chaos without seeing a single enemy soldier.
So the clan that thought they were basically gods gets routed by ducks.
Pretty much. It's this perfect symbolic moment, right? Shows their spirit is already broken. The universe itself is kind of laughing at their pride.
That's incredible. And then Kiyomori himself. His end isn't pretty, is it?
No, it's depicted as truly horrific. This happens around book six. It's classic karmic punishment. He gets consumed by this raging fever.
So hot, they say water sizzled on his skin.
Yeah, something like that. Consumed by rage, calling for the Minamoto leader's head, even as he dies. His death really marks the point of no return for the hike. Their fierce leader is gone.
Which brings us to phase three, the Genji, I mean, the Minamoto strike back.
Right. With Kiyomori out of the picture, the Minamoto really step up. You've got Minamoto no Yoritomo, the strategist in the east.
And his younger brother, Yoshitsune, the brilliant field commander.
That's him. Yoshitsune is the tactical genius, maybe a bit impulsive, but incredibly effective on the battlefield. He starts turning the tide.
With moves like that famous charge at Ichinotani.
Exactly. Leading cavalry down a cliff face everyone thought was impassable. Pure military brilliance. Completely routed the Heike there. It's legendary stuff.
But the story doesn't just focus on the battles, does it? It keeps coming back to the human cost.
Absolutely. And this phase has one of the most famous, most poignant episodes. The story of Kumagai no Zani and Taira no Atsumori.
Right. Kumagai is a veteran Minamoto warrior, and Atsumori is a young Heike noble, a musician.
Yeah, a young, refined flute player. Kumagai defeats him in battle, and Atsumori is maybe the same age as Kumagai's own son.
And the warrior code Bushido demands.
It demands Kumagai kill him for honor, to prevent him rallying troops. That's his duty, his giri. But his human feeling, his ninji, is just screaming against it.
That conflict. Duty versus compassion.
It breaks Kumagai. He kills the boy as duty dictates, but it shatters his spirit. He realizes this warrior life forces you to destroy the very thing that makes you human.
So he becomes a monk.
Yeah. He renounces violence, spends the rest of his life praying for Atsumori's soul. It's a powerful statement on the true cost of war and duty.
Wow. Okay, so the hikers are losing. Their spirit is broken. Phase four must be the end game.
Annihilation. It all comes down to this massive naval battle at Dannoura. The Heikes are cornered.
They fight hard, though.
Fiercely. They even have the advantage with the tides initially, but then the tide turns. Literally and figuratively, their fate is sealed.
And the ending is just tragic. Kiyomori's widow.
Yeah, Lady Nai. She knows it's over. She takes the child, Emperor Antoku, in her arms, tells him they're going to a capital beneath the waves.
And jumps into the sea.
Jumps into the sea, taking the emperor and one of the imperial regalia, the sacred sword Kusanagi, with her, lost to the depths. The hike line is extinguished, utterly destroyed.
But the story doesn't end with the victors celebrating.
No, and that's what's so remarkable. The final part, the initiates chapter, doesn't focus on Yoritomo, the winner. It focuses on Kiyomori's daughter, Empress Kenrimonin.
She survives.
She survives and becomes a Buddhist nun, and she spends her life praying. Not just for the Heike dead, but for everyone, both sides, Heike and Genji.
That changes the whole feel of it. It moves beyond just a war story.
Completely. It transforms it into this profound spiritual text about finding peace, salvation, transcending the whole cycle of violence.
Okay, so if we pull back from the specifics, the samurai, the battles, what are the big themes here? The takeaways for us?
Well, the absolute biggest is theme one. Impermanence, Muju. It's hammered home constantly.
Meiji-on bells.
Exactly. The proud do not endure. But it's not just philosophy, it's practical. The hike fell because they desperately tried to cling to power to make it permanent. The lesson is resilience through acceptance. Accept that things change. Good times pass, but so do bad times.
Right. And theme two, hubris is self-destructive. Kiyomori's arrogance that not a Heike, not a human line. It wasn't just bad PR. It created the very conditions for their downfall. It bred resentment, isolated them.
It's the ultimate cautionary tale for any leader, any organization. Arrogance makes you blind. Disregarding dissent ensures collapse. It's almost like Inga, karmic retribution, playing out on an institutional level. Unethical actions create systemic failure down the line.
Makes sense. And theme three, duty versus compassion. That Kumagai and Atsumori story really hits hard.
It shows the strict adherence to duty, to giri, especially in codes like Bushido or even, you know, corporate loyalty. It can force you to violate basic human compassion, Ninjin.
And the implication is?
The implication, especially with the ending focusing on Kanryamon, is that true wisdom, maybe true peace, lies leaning towards compassion, towards spiritual understanding, not just rigid adherence to rules.
Okay, those are powerful themes. And the book itself is full of memorable lines, isn't it? You mentioned the opening.
Oh, absolutely. That opening stanza just sets the tone perfectly. The sound of the Jion Shoja bells echoes the impermanence of all things.
The proud do not endure. They are like a dream on a spring night. The mighty fall at last. They are as dust before the wind. I mean, that just lays it all out, doesn't it?
It tells you right up front, don't expect a celebration of victory here. This is about the tragedy inherent in power itself.
And then there's that peak arrogance quote, anyone who is not a hike is not a human being. Just, wow.
Yeah.
The ultimate disconnect.
It perfectly captures that moment of fatal hubris. It's why their enemies felt so justified, you know?
Yeah. And is there one that captures the spiritual side? The looking beyond worldly things?
There are many, but the essence, maybe paraphrased, is something like, the cherry blossoms scatter, but the tree endures to bloom again. Human glory fades, but the Dharma remains eternal.
So look beyond the temporary wins and losses. Look for something deeper, more lasting.
Exactly. Find meaning beyond the material world, beyond status.
So how does this all, you know, apply today? How can 12th century samurai help us navigate modern life?
Well, application one, leadership and humility. Kiyomori's story is practically a manual on how not to lead long term.
Right. See power as a responsibility, not a possession. Mm. Understand it's temporary.
Yes, and actively seek out criticism. Don't isolate yourself in an echo chamber of agreement. Stay grounded. Your success doesn't make you infallible.
Okay. What else?
Application two, managing change. The epic shows that big transitions, whether in nations or companies, always involve loss. You can't just focus on the winner or the new direction.
You have to acknowledge what's being lost, the human cost.
You have to. If you just celebrate the victory and ignore the pain of the transition, you breed resentment and instability. You need empathy during change.
And a third one, maybe from the ending.
Application three, finding meaning beyond winning. Empress Kenrimonin's path. It's a powerful reminder, ultimate fulfillment, lasting peace. Maybe it doesn't come from climbing the ladder or winning the battle.
But from reflection.
Compassion.
Spiritual growth.
Exactly. Finding meaning outside of just worldly success and status, that's perhaps the deepest lesson.
You know, what really struck me going through this again is that shift you mentioned, how it starts feeling like this chronicle of war, battles, strategy, heroes. Mm-hmm. But by the end, it's transformed into something else entirely. It's almost a prayer. A plea for salvation for everyone involved. It completely rejects that simple winner-takes-all story we often expect.
Yeah, it denies easy answers. And I think that connects to the bigger picture. The enduring insight is just how universal these patterns of rise and fall are. Muju isn't just a Japanese concept.
It applies everywhere.
To every leader, every company, every empire. The hike isn't just history. It gives us these ethical and philosophical tools to look at power structures now and see their fragility.
Okay, here's a final thought for you, the listener. To take away.
Mm.
Remember the victor, Minamoto no Yoritomo?
Yeah.
He won, established the first shogunate, brought stability.
Right.
But one of his first major acts, he turned on his own brother, Yoshitsune, the military genius who basically won him the war, hunted him down, and destroyed him.
Yeah, a tragic end for Yoshitsune.
So what does that internal conflict, that betrayal within the winning side, tell us about power itself? Does it suggest that even the victor can't escape that cycle of violence, of impermanence? That maybe every victory already contains the seeds of the next tragedy? Something to think about.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ikatra Foundation.